few astronomical spectacles unfold so quickly or occur on so precisely irregular a schedule. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Perhaps the earliest written record of a solar eclipse dates from China over 4,000 years ago. The story goes that a malicious dragon devoured the sun, but was frightened away by a great noise and commotion made by a fearful population. The emperor is said to have been so furious at his court astronomers, Si and Ho, for failing to predict this event, that he had them put to death. Fred Espenac has had a much more successful career in astrophysics. A scientist emeritus at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, he has developed highly accurate tools and techniques for eclipse prediction, and observed numerous eclipses on his own. With today's modern understanding, it's possible to know precisely where and when solar eclipses will be visible, allowing the scientific community to share with the public these rare opportunities to see the motions of the solar system in real time. Western World's Parshati Patel spoke to Mr. Espenac at the Starfest public astronomy event near Mount Forest, Ontario.
Okay, so thank you for joining us today, and let's start off by talking about your tag, Mr. Eclipse Chaser. So first of all, let me ask you, how did you actually went around chasing? Like, how did it all start?
Well, I got interested in astronomy as a boy. I think it was 7 or 8 years old when I got a look through my first telescope, and got very interested in amateur astronomy as a kid. And sometime during that period, looking through a couple of books on astronomy, I found out about this solar eclipse that was going to pass through the eastern United States in 1970. And I must have known about this eclipse at least for 5 years ahead of time. And I was living on the east coast of the U.S. in New York. So I thought this might be my chance of a lifetime, or maybe one or two chances of a lifetime, to see a total eclipse. And I basically put that on my calendar and was determined to see that. By the time 1970 rolled around, at that point I was now a senior in high school. I had just gotten a driver's license.
Okay.
And I begged my parents to let me borrow the car to drive 800 or 900 kilometers from the home to the path of the eclipse. And I drove down there, was fortunate to have good weather. And in spite of the fact that I had read an awful lot about eclipses, when I actually saw the eclipse, I was speechless. It was way more than I had been led to believe, even reading everything that I could about it. And as soon as the eclipse was over, I realized I can't allow this to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I've got to see another one. And the next one that was taking place was 2 years later in eastern Canada.
Okay.
And by then I was in university. I drove up that summer to try to see that eclipse, but unfortunately I was clouded out. So I discovered my first disappointment with eclipses, that even though you might know exactly where and when to be, you can't predict the weather. That sort of got the ball rolling, because at that point I started looking ahead at future eclipses and figuring out which ones I could go to.
So yeah, you're known for prediction of these solar eclipses. So what are the kinds of solar eclipses, and what kind of information can one get, just being as a scientist, from these kind of solar eclipses?
Well, there are basically three or maybe four different types of solar eclipses. There's the partial eclipse, where only the penumbral part of the moon's shadow hits the Earth. And those don't have any scientific value, not anymore. The next sort of type of an eclipse is an annular eclipse, where the moon passes centrally between the Earth and the sun, but it's at a greater distance in its orbit. So it appears smaller than the sun, so during the midpoint of the eclipse, it can't completely cover the sun's disk, and you are left with a ring of light surrounding the moon. ring of the sun's photosphere. And although those are more interesting than partials, again, they're not nearly as valuable scientifically because you can't see the sun's outer atmosphere, the corona, during an annular eclipse. The remaining sunlight is still too bright. The really cream of the crop among eclipses is the total eclipse, because then the moon is along a certain part of its orbit where it appears larger than the sun. So during the central part of the eclipse, it completely covers the sun's disk. And when that happens, the sky grows dark enough to reveal this very faint halo, the solar corona, which surrounds the sun. And that corona is about a million times fainter than the surface of the sun. So you really have to have a darker sky to see it. It's always there in bright daylight, but the sky is brighter than the corona. So you need that moon in there to darken the sky enough to reveal the corona. And the corona is still an object of quite a bit of mystery in terms of the science of it, because the surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, 10,000 centigrade, and the corona is 1 to 2 million degrees. So it's much hotter, but it's outside of the main sun. So one of the big issues that it still remains unanswered about the solar corona is exactly how it's heated. Why is it so much hotter than the corona? That's what a lot of scientists are still pursuing in terms of trying to understand the physics of what's going on in the corona. The fourth type of solar eclipse is pretty unusual, because this one involves the vertex of the moon's shadow, where it can just intersect the surface of the Earth at certain points along the eclipse path. So at certain points of the eclipse path, the eclipse is annular, and along other sections of the path, it's total. So it's sort of the transition between an annular eclipse and a total, where you get some of each depending on where you happen to be along the path of the eclipse.
So you have witnessed around 24, or you tried to witness 24, and out of that you were able to see at least 19, thanks to the good weather. Would you mind to elaborate more on how many of the total did you see, how many were annular, and your experience with each of them?
Well, those numbers that you quoted, those 24 eclipses, I'm just counting the totals.
Oh, okay.
Those are just the
just
totals.
The totals.
20,
okay.
24 totals that I've been to. I've probably been, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I've probably been to 6 or 8 annular eclipses and a handful of partial eclipses. But the totals are the ones I pay more attention to in terms of keeping track, because that's where you see the corona, which is the most spectacular part of the eclipse.
Okay. And have you been using, okay, because you're interested, you know, you're chasing the eclipse, have you been using the data that you actually collect? You know, or are you just, you know, using it to have fun? Because some people kind of want to do amateur astronomy in terms of looking at the sun, but collecting data and supplying it to scientists who actually do science with that.
By and large, I'm just doing it for fun, just because the corona is so amazingly beautiful. Although some of my images have been used by some of my colleagues and been used for various studies. But by and large, I'm just doing it because it's such a unique and exciting astronomical event. And now that I'm retired, I'm more interested in having more fun.
Yes, I can imagine that. Okay, so I went to your talk. I saw that you actually witnessed the longest 9-minute total eclipse. Can you share your experience with that? Because it's kind of unusual. We know people have seen 3-minute, 2-minute, few seconds, but 9 minutes, it's probably the longest I've ever heard.
Right. Just in terms of the mechanics of an eclipse, the longest duration that you can possibly get on the Earth's surface, if everything lines up just right, is right around 7.5 minutes. So how did we get almost nine and a half minutes? Well, we had a group that chartered an aircraft, and we flew out of Tahiti in 2010 to fly right along the shadow of the moon as it raced across the ocean. And that way we couldn't keep up with the shadow, but we could slow the shadow down as it passed over us, so we could extend the duration of totality. Mm-hmm. If you had been on a ship or a boat down on the ocean surface for that eclipse, with our plane above flying overhead, the people down on the surface on the ocean would have seen an eclipse that lasted a little over 5 minutes. But because we were flying along with the shadow, we were able to extend it to almost 9.5 minutes.
Okay. So now I want to kind of jump to something else that you have done, is you actually studied the atmosphere of other planets using infrared spectrometers. Would you mind to go a little bit into what you did?
Sure. My work was at Goddard Space Flight Center, which is in Greenbelt, Maryland. And it's a NASA facility. And we had a department there called the Planetary Systems Branch, and that specializes in the infrared part of the spectrum and studying the atmospheres of the planets. The temperature of most of the planets when you get up into the upper atmospheres are relatively cool, and at those temperatures, sunlight interacts with the molecules in the upper atmosphere, and the spectrum that you get in the infrared is produced. Well, let me stop for a second. Normally, when you think of spectra, you think of the energy that's released from the orbits of an atom as electrons change energy shells. But when you're talking about infrared spectroscopy, instead of the transitions among the energy shells in an atom, you're talking about the quantized energy states in the vibration and the rotational states of molecules. So in the infrared, you can actually look at molecule species, carbon dioxide, methane, ammonia, in the atmospheres of the planets, because they give off unique spectra just like atoms do in the sun. So we're looking at molecules in the atmospheres of the planets. And we were looking at, in particular, carbon dioxide in Venus. We were looking at carbon dioxide in Mars as well as ozone. We were looking at hydrocarbons in the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn, a little bit of Neptune and Uranus. But they were getting quite cold out that far from the solar system. So they're much more difficult to observe because the signal is quite small. But the instrument that we were using was developed by our team, and it's called an infrared heterodyne spectrometer. And the idea here was to mix the signal from the telescope, the beam of the telescope, looking at a planet, with a lot of electronics and an infrared laser, and we were able to look at the difference frequency between the telescope beam and the laser on the table to allow us to see the spectrum in very, very high resolution. So we don't just see a line, we actually see the shape, the physical shape of the line. And by being able to see the actual shape of a spectral line allows you to extract the actual physics that's going on in the atmosphere. You can actually determine the temperature layers in the atmosphere. So that's one thing that we would do, would be to try to invert the atmosphere and come up with the temperature profile through the atmosphere of, for instance, Mars. You could also look at how a particular molecule, say ethane in Jupiter, how that's varying over the course of a rotation, or seasonally looking at the equator versus the poles, mm-hmm. and try to get a handle on some of the physics that's going on in those upper atmospheres. And a lot of this work was sort of coordinated to support some of the NASA missions, because this gave an opportunity to provide ground-based observations while, for instance, Galileo or Cassini was in orbit and taking measurements from there. We would be able to take simultaneous measurements from the ground. Most of the time, we take these measurements from the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which has very transparent atmosphere. It's up high enough that we're above a lot of the water vapor. Water vapor is a problem in the infrared because there are a lot of water vapor lines that block the view of the planets. But by being above most of the water vapor, then we've got what are called windows where we can look through where the water vapor lines would normally be and be able to see the spectral lines visible in the planets themselves. So Mauna Kea was a great place for doing that.
You study atmosphere of planets, and then you're looking at the atmosphere of the star, our sun. Was there any relationship?
They were pretty separate from each other, because in terms of the eclipse work I was doing, that was involved not so much with understanding the physics of the sun's corona. That was involved much more in the actual mechanics of predicting when an eclipse is going to take place, how long it's going to last, what's the exact path of totality. So that's the aspect of eclipse work that I was doing with NASA, was the actual prediction of the circumstances and the details of each one of these eclipses. And in light of that, when I first started doing this eclipse prediction work, I think the first paper that I published on it was for the 1979 eclipse that passed through the U.S. and Western Canada. And of course, back in those days, there was no internet. Over the course of the next 15 years, I did more and more predictions and published more papers. By the time the mid-90s rolled around, then the internet became available. And at a certain point, one of my tasks at NASA was to develop a website for our department, providing information about my colleagues, their curriculum vitae, what types of research they were on. But at the same time, I learned how to program in HTML and program a website, which I set up for our department. And I thought, gee, you know, I ought to be putting some of the eclipse predictions out on the web as well. So that was really the starting point for the NASA Eclipse website, starting from that. And over the course of the years after that, into 2000 and beyond, that website has grown larger and larger to the point now where I've got predictions online for every solar eclipse and every lunar eclipse over a 5,000-year span. Okay. And there are maps and diagrams for every single eclipse over that period of time. And it's all there out on the website, available to the general public.
That's really impressive, 5,000 years. Yeah. Would you mind to just like highlight how exactly do you predict? I'm sure there is some orbital dynamics in there, because you obviously need to know the path of moon, sun, earth.
Well, probably the starting point for predicting an eclipse, whether it's a solar eclipse or a lunar eclipse, is you need to have a good prediction, a good model for exactly where the sun and the moon are with respect to the Earth. And there are a number of different ways of doing that. And my techniques for doing that were modest at the beginning. And now I'm using the same ephemeris that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory uses for planning planetary missions with spacecraft. So the scope and the accuracy of these ephemeris over the past 10 or 15 years has really grown dramatically. And at this point, that's the data that goes into the starting point of predicting eclipses. Beyond that, it involves a lot of spherical trigonometry, of looking at the position of the moon shadow as it's projected into space, and then it's projecting onto the surface of the Earth, which is an oblate spheroid, and you have to model how that shadow moves with respect to the moon's orbit and with respect to the Earth's not only motion with respect to the moon, but also the rotation of the Earth and the angles involved in all of this stuff. So it's a huge amount of geometry involved, but that lends itself perfectly to computers, because that's what they're designed to do. So you've got to sit down and develop computer programs that code all the proper equations once you've got the positions of the sun and the moon as a function of time with respect to the Earth, and just eventually develop the models that will tell you all the details about the eclipse. And then you have to interface that with databases that have mapping data, so you can produce diagrams showing maps. Other programs might be designed to give you tabular data of the position of the moon every so many minutes during the eclipse path, and the altitude of the sun, the altitude of the moon, the azimuth, the duration of the eclipse, the width of the path. All these kinds of details can be determined once you've got this basic model set up.
I see that now that you have retired, you have built your own observatory. And would you mind to shed a quick light on what exactly, how that came about, and what's the future to that? So what do you plan on doing with your own observatory?
Right. Well, as I mentioned, I'd become an amateur astronomer as a boy. And one of the frustrating things living along the East Coast is that not only were the skies not dark enough, they were getting worse. I could see a lot more when I was 10 or 12 years old than I could by the time I was 20 or 25. Light pollution was just a growing problem. The only time I could really get a good look at the sky was when I drove hours and hours away from home. And I always had this desire to build an observatory someplace where the sky was dark enough where I could enjoy the dark sky all the time. And that was sort of a lifelong ambition. And as I approached retirement, I started to think about what I wanted to do after I retired. And that idea came back to me, that I really wanted to leave the city areas, go out someplace very rural where there would be very little lighting, so that I really could get back in touch with the night sky. And that's how the idea of building an observatory started. I searched, did a lot of research on it, and really decided that the American Southwest would be the best place to go for dark skies. I also had an affinity to that part of the country. I love the beauty of the desert. And about 10 years ago, while thinking about these things, I went to a star party in Florida, a winter star party, and the Canadian amateur astronomer and astrophotographer Jack Newton was there, and he was discussing this planned astronomy community that he was in the process of designing in southern Arizona called Arizona Sky Village. And I said, Jack, I want to know more about this. I got onto his email list, and 6 months later, he contacted me and said, well, we've got community property lots now set down on paper, and you can go online and pick out a property and put down a deposit for it. So I did that. A couple months later, took a trip out to Arizona because I hadn't seen the land yet. So I wanted to get out there and take a look around. I was actually looking at a couple of different lots, but I picked a particular lot and decided that that's where we were going to build a retirement home. And, you know, this was thinking quite a bit forward because this was only in 2001 and I didn't retire for another 8 years. But thinking ahead.
Yes.
So by the time I retired, we had built a home there that we could only visit on vacation time because I was still working at Goddard. But by the time 2009 rolled around and I retired, we had the house waiting there for us. We moved a lot of furniture there. And then the fun part began because then I actually started building the observatory. Of course, I'd been thinking about it for quite a few years. And by that point, I had some detailed plans to have the observatory built. And that took about a year before it was operational. And right now, I'm having a lot of fun just learning the ins and outs of CCD imaging. I'm just enjoying taking pretty pictures of the night sky. I'm not at the moment trying to do any kind of fancy science. It's just a pleasure to be out. The aesthetics of seeing the Milky Way in a truly pristine dark sky is just something I've been dreaming about most of my life. And now I get to go out and do it almost every night.
Lucky you, I should say that. All right, thank you so much. That was very interesting, and I hope you have clear skies in Arizona always, and hope you get to admire more and more of the universe.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
All right, so we just listened to my interview with Dr. Fred Espinar, and this was, again, taken at one of the star parties I went to this year. And he's an eclipse chaser. So I've heard people hunting for comets and other things, but an eclipse chaser. Mm-hmm. That was the first time ever. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting to see, you know. That's his hobby.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to great lengths to just see this few minutes of spectacular view. And even do some science with it.
Yeah, and you know, everybody finds something to be interested in the sky, and eclipses are one of these things that, while they're rare, you will know when and where they will happen, right? You never know when you're going to find a comet, but you know exactly where an eclipse is going to happen.
Yeah. So. And he was one of the many people who actually calculated and make models for calculating the time when these eclipses would occur, where they would occur.
Yeah.
And we have a good handle for next, I think, I don't know, 100 years or something. And we know where exactly they're going to occur. So people who are really interested in things like that can plan their trips accordingly, I would say. But it's great to see that he has invested so much time, and I would say even so much money. I remember from his talk, he said after his first trip to see the eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
He actually wanted to do this every time there's an eclipse nearby.
Yeah.
The thing is, you need money.
Yeah, of course.
And he actually found funding from university and places or professors who would fund, things like an adventure trip to
eclipse observation kind of stuff.
Yeah, and not only just an observation, I think it's also the fact that you're generating people's interest by doing things like this, whether it's for a college or university or young adults, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I like this strategy of using airplanes to prolong the eclipse.
Was actually, the time he went, I actually did receive an invitation to go to that plane.
Oh, yeah?
So a lot of money for me.
Of course.
Being a student. But I had a chance to actually fly in the plane, which takes off from India, and be with all the other amateur astronomers who actually are going to be, chasing the eclipse. But it was full by the time within, few days. It was full. So you can see.
So there's clearly some interest, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of interest in chasing the eclipse. And you would say it's different. If you're chasing a comet and you have a spectacular view for a long time, you can sit there and look at it.
Mm-hmm.
This one, because you were looking at the eclipse through the while following the shadow.
Yeah.
It was for a long time, 9 minutes, as he mentioned. And that's not normally achievable.
Yeah.
So this is a good idea. I think every time now that we're going to have an eclipse, I'm sure there are going to be flights that would especially just take people to you know, in the shadow.
And talk about advancing our understanding of orbital mechanics. I mean, there was a time when we didn't know exactly how many days there were in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know the geometry of the movement of the sun and the moon and the earth well enough that we know exactly which part of the earth the shadow will cover at which time.
Yeah.
Yeah, such that you can fly an airplane into it.
Yeah, which I think is very interesting. So people who ever can afford it have been, you know, going to such places. I think, and this is very recently, it's not been up for long. It's just in the past 3 or 5 years that people have been, you know, either have a jet, you know, private jet hired or have these commercial flights being flown and sell tickets to people who would like to pay for such an awesome view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you've talked also about dark sky preserves, and which is an interesting movement that's finally starting to come up with places that have sparse settlement or large areas of darkness are starting to see that as a resource. And there, you know, you can go to this kind of place and see the stars reliably. The eclipse, on the other hand, it's going to be on one particular day 7 years from now, and you better be in the right place.
Yeah, I really like that. That's why I was so intrigued by the fact when he was giving the talk, he was talking about, he showed the pictures, he was talking about how the sky is so different at that settlement than compared to the cities around it. And because I've been to the star party, I know like how different the sky looks.
Yeah.
When you then, if anyone of the listeners who have not been, just take a day and go out in a dark, secluded area and try look at the sky, and you will see way more stars. Even harder to pick out constellations. I had a hard time picking out constellations.
Because there's too many stars.
You cannot pick out constellations. There's very hard to pick out constellations. But that just shows you how much of a universe is out there that we are not able to see because of the pollution and light pollution, air pollution.
Because often if you're in a major city, you'll see only the first magnitude stars.
Yeah.
When I used to live in Holland, you could only see, on many days, something like 10 or 20 stars in the whole sky, only the very brightest one. But here in North America, where we have a little bit more space, in the U.S. Southwest and many, many parts of Canada, in my home region in Northern Ontario, you can see a lot of things if you get just a little bit away from the lights.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from India, and back there, picking out constellations, you're not going to find them because it's so much pollution. Even if you go outside the city, it's still hard to find.
Is it air pollution or bright lights?
Air pollution.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's very bad air pollution. And then there's also light pollution now, given that like most of the villages now have electricity and, you know, the light pollution just adds up onto the air pollution. And in Canada, we do have, you know, places which are reserved at, as dark sky reserves, and around it is probably the best place to go see stars and obviously our galaxy.
Yeah.
But in India, at least from what I know, there are none.
Oh, that's...
So basically, you probably would have to go to the mountains or something to see that. But so if those kind of projects are generated, you know, people would like to go to such places and look at the stars and actually understand that there's more than just a few stars in the sky.
Yeah.
And there are people who actually study them, and there is a reason why all the telescopes are, you know, mounted at high altitudes. Light pollution, air pollution needs to be avoided to look at the sky. And we send out telescopes in the space because there are regions where we cannot see.
Mm-hmm.
And just basically not only for people who want to be, go ahead and want to be astronomers or planetary scientists, but also just in general for public to know where we are.
Yeah, I mean, when you're living in a city with, continuous overcast weather or just bright lights and things, it's very easy to forget just how much access you have visually to the rest of the universe. You know, between us standing here on the surface of the Earth and the giant vacuum of the galaxy and beyond, there's a very thin layer of transparent air.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're up in one of these dark places, immediately you can see that you're standing on the edge of, one of these objects that you know, the rest of the universe is right there.
Yeah.
And of course, with eclipses, then you have the,
real-time geometric demonstration
yeah.
that everything is moving and you're on one of those moving things.
Yeah, and I would like to point out, this is my first time going to a star party and actually seeing the Milky Way galaxy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was my first time because, as I said, I'm from India, so you cannot even see most of these stars or even constellations, so forget about seeing the galaxy. And so this is my first time doing it. And I was even lucky enough to look at the sun through a lot of telescopes. So they did have a lot of solar telescopes.
With filters.
With filters, obviously. Yeah.
Of course.
Do it without filters.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to see how much off a hot ball of fire the sun is. There's so much going on its surface.
Yeah, you were able to see prominences,
yes,
and sunspots. And,
I was lucky enough to see a huge prominence.
Yeah.
Pretty big compared to a small telescope that I was looking through. I was able to see a lot of sunspots. There was a huge sunspot, luckily, right at the time when I was there. And we looked at it a few hours and you could see actually moving.
Of course.
Which was, you know, immense. Like, you can see the actual granules and things like that using some of the telescopes. And, and I was so amazed. I mean, you study stars, but when you really look at one,
Up close,
how hot they are. And
yeah.
Yet so important for us to live.
Of course, yeah. And here we are stuck living with it right there, dependent on it.
Yeah, and I was really amazed to see when he talked about the beats that you actually see. So in his talk, he actually showed a few pictures where when you see the eclipse, there is a point where right when the moon covers the edges of the sun and you see this really spectacular small beads.
Okay.
These are basically the outer layer of the sun that you really don't get to see it because it's so hot when you look at the sun through the telescope. So those are very important study, and basically a lot of solar physicists actually study those to understand what's going on the surface as well.
Oh, okay, I see. Well, certainly sounds like an exciting event you guys are going
to.
Yeah. You get to talk to some interesting people and learn quite some interesting things.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great experience.
It was fun.
That's our show for this week. Western World is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western World was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel and Raymond Francis. Our editors were David Kirsch and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for making World Enough in Time to join us tonight. I hope you can do so again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.